I'm Jill Surgeson, a nurse midwife and researcher fascinated by the concept of trust and its role in our most meaningful relationships. Trust isn't just personal. It influences our health, our communities, and our institutions. In this podcast, we'll explore how trust manifests across different aspects of society, where it thrives, where it breaks down, and what we can do to build it. Through conversations with experts from a variety of disciplines, we'll examine how trustworthiness can lead to a more equitable and fulfilling world. Welcome to Trust Fund. Oh, the American dream. If you work hard, keep your nose to the grindstone, we can all achieve the same level of success and personal satisfaction. Sounds okay, but when I look around my life, too often that equation just doesn't make sense. Too often I see folks working really hard, doing all the right things, and still struggling to find comfort and success in their lives. Which makes me think, is the American dream more like a fairy tale? Today, I have the privilege of talking to Jay Pearson. Dr. Pearson's research, teaching, and advocacy addresses how politically sponsored and structurally rooted social inequality influences the social determinations of health disadvantage. A native of Hertford County, North Carolina, Pearson's early experience in the rural agricultural South shaped and informed his professional interest. Pearson began his public health career as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras, where he worked as a child survival health specialist, training and evaluating midwives and local health workers. Upon returning to the U.S., Jay worked as a health educator with the East Coast Migrant Health Project, later designing and implementing health and safety training for Spanish-speaking factory workers, pesticide safety training with multi-ethnic farm worker populations, and lead poisoning prevention in an impoverished urban community. While pursuing his doctoral degree at the University of Michigan, Dr. Pearson began to study the social determinants of population health. He is particularly interested in the health effects of conventional and non-conventional resources associated with racial assignment, ethnic identity, national origin, immigration, and cultural orientations. He is currently tenured faculty at Duke University. Dr. Pearson, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
You have a really intriguing background, and I think it's going to become germane to our conversation today. And I wanted to ask you if you could share a story that I recently heard from you about one of your first jobs. And this was, I'll set it up for you, picking cucumbers as a child. Was it Hertford County?
It was in Hertford County, North Carolina. That is correct.
And I'd love to hear the story. And I also am just interested in how, if any, that experience had an impact on your ability to trust those in power. Was that a critical moment for you, a core memory? And if so, how did that alter the trajectory of your life?
Yeah, well, it indeed was a pivotal moment in my young development. And the way the story goes, you know, I'm from a rural agricultural region. And the neighborhood that I lived in, my family and I lived in a trailer park. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the growing season, often when there was agricultural work, recruiters would come to the trailer park and recruit grown men and children to come out and do agricultural work. I was 12 years old at the time. And one of those recruiters, I shall not name that human being, okay, but it was someone who actually knew us and said, hey, you know, we have work picking cucumbers. You get paid X amount per bushel basket of cucumbers. And so it's piecemeal work. And here's how much you can make in a week if you're willing to work hard. And he told us something like $150. And so about 10 of us from my neighborhood agreed to go. And on the bus ride over, there was a bus that came to the neighborhood to pick us up and then take us to the fields. We were asking questions. And our understanding was that we picked a day, and then at the end of the day, we would be paid.
Okay.
And so all of us worked the entire day, and we were super excited, as you imagine, a group of, I guess, I was probably the young, no, my brother was young, and he was 11.
What year was this?
This was in the late 70s, so maybe 79.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the summer of 79, no, the summer of 80, sorry, summer of 80. So we went out, and we worked hard all day. And at the end of the day, when we expected to get paid, we were told that we were not going to get paid and that we had misunderstood and that you get paid on Tuesdays and you get paid on Fridays. And so, you know, as you can imagine, some of the young men were upset and some of them were upset with me because I actually took it upon myself to go out and try to recruit additional folks, you know, and say, hey, let's just make some money. So let's come do this thing. I can't remember exactly how many, but three or four of the guys refused to come back the next day. I went back on Tuesday in good faith, truly believing that at the end of the day, we were going to get paid. And so now there are seven or so of us, and we go back and we work a full day. And at the end of the day, once again, we're told that we somehow have misunderstood and that we get paid on Wednesdays and Fridays or Saturdays if you came to work on Saturday. So everybody quit with the exception of my brother. Well, I didn't quit, and I wouldn't allow my brother and my closest friend to quit either. And so three of us out of the initial 10 went back on Wednesday. And, you know, as you probably are starting to figure, we didn't get paid on Wednesday either. And so my brother was upset, and my closest friend was upset, and they both sort of yelled at me. But I went back and worked all day Thursday and all day Friday with the expectation of getting paid my full week's pay on Friday evening. And indeed, I did get paid on Friday, but by my count over the course of the week, I had picked $92 worth of produce, in this case cucumbers, and I got paid $17. And so I confronted the person who came out to the neighborhood to recruit us there at the pay station. I'd have a little notebook and kept a tally of everything that I'd picked. And there was a nice lady there, actually, when we came to turn in our buckets, who also had kept a record. And she was a little bit embarrassed because she knew what the game was, right? And so I confronted the recruiter on Friday. And he said, well, you have to come back and confront the owner. Let's call him Captain Percy. That's what they called him. You have to confront this person directly. And he's like, and, you know, he won't be here tomorrow on Saturday, but you can come and work again. And so I was like, no, I'm not going back to work tomorrow. I was like, but I'll be here on Monday. And so Monday came and I actually caught the bus, went to the field. Indeed, the landowner, the grower, the producer was there. And I confronted him directly. And he said something to me like, well, if you want to make more money, you're going to have to work harder. In fact, it's important that you and people like you learn what it means to work if you want to get ahead in life, because without that commitment to working, you know, you're sitting at home with your mama on welfare taking my tax dollars. This is literally what he said to me. Now, this is after I'd spent a week, right, working in the fields picking these cucumbers. And so, you know, I'm a country boy, and all country boys, if they're good country boys, carry a pocket knife. So I put my hand on my knife because I'm like, I'm going to have to cut them, right? And I say that facetiously, and I can laugh about it now, but, you know, that's at that time, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and I come from a culture where when you're mistreated, those are the types of things that happen.
Yeah.
I thought better of it, which I think was absolutely positively the best thing in the world. I didn't cut him. And the reason that I thought better of it is because the simple truth is, this is a landowning and otherwise wealthy white man in a rural southern community. I am a young man of color, and the power dynamics that existed between the two of us were such that there was absolutely nothing I could do to mitigate or offset or make right this absolute exploitation, because that's what it was, right? And so it you know, I do research on the health effects of inequality, but it was almost literally in that moment that this notion of asymmetries in power, status, and standing that informed the work that I do as a function of historical mechanisms that set up these dynamics, right, such that this man could sit in this position and essentially do to me whatever he wanted with impunity, and I had no mechanism, right, to work back against that. And so I began to think about why that was, and perhaps more importantly, what I could do to not find myself in that position ever again, right? And yeah. One of the mechanisms that I had already identified, and fortunately something that I enjoyed, was formal education, school. I loved to read. I enjoyed going to school. I liked doing school work. And even then, essentially as a preteen, I had almost an intuitive sense that if social mobility were going to be legitimately possible for someone who comes from what I come from, you know, I grew up in abject poverty, first generation college student, maybe we'll talk about that later, it was most likely to be negotiated through formal educational institutions, right?
Could you explain to us the, I'm going to call it the fallacy of egalitarian meritocracy, or you might know it by the American dream?
Yeah, the American creed, or the myth of egalitarian meritocracy in the United States of America, and it's central to our national identity. So we'll start with egalitarianism because, you know, if you do a historical review, the egalitarian component has existed for longer than these notions of meritocracy. But egalitarianism at the core is belief that opportunity structures or access to resources, and later we've added protection from risk, are justly and fairly distributed such that all population groups and individuals that belong to them have the same or at least similar opportunities to succeed in the United States of America, right? And it's at the center of U.S. national identity. That notion began to be formulated and brought to bear before the formal founding of the nation state. And belief in the egalitarian component of the American creed of egalitarian meritocracy, even until today, is somewhere, the last time I looked at national survey data, in the neighborhood of 75%, 75% or so of all folks in the country actually believe that this is true. Now, a simple review of the historical record also teaches us that Northwestern European colonizers, you know, all men, all by the standards of the time, met the criteria to be included in the white population, and all of whom were well-to-do, you know, wrote all of those early documents. They laid out these notions of the wonderful United States of America. No women, no people of color. And at that time, all Christians, indeed all Protestants, no Catholics, right? And so this notion of egalitarianism was effectively constrained to the folks who conceived of it and wrote those initial documents, to these well-to-do Protestant Northwestern European colonizing white men, and was not, you know, for at least the subsequent 150 years or so, you know, from the founding of the nation, even contested as pertains to being expanded or extended to other populations. And so it has existed, but, you know, for roughly 5 to 7% of the total population of the emerging nation at that time, right? So meritocracy, the belief that we come to occupy the positions that we ultimately occupy in broader society as a function of the skillful and responsible application of access to these resources or protection from these risks came about later, actually in the 20th century. And this notion of meritocracy, as adapted by politicians first in the United States of America, emerged from a satirical work written by a French author in the 30s or 40s, and that a few others picked up on and said, you know, this guy wrote that. And keep in mind, we're talking about the French and the British, so this is in Europe, where monarchies and that kind of born into elitism still existed. And so it was kind of a satire to say, we all know that if you're born to the lowest class here, that's where you remain, and sure. that the monarchs and, you know, those folks continue to occupy their positions. But somehow, this satire got picked up, and folks here strategically applied it and melded it to this notion of egalitarianism and said, not just, you know, do we refuse to see that entire populations and certainly the individuals that belong to them have been formally denied opportunity to engage our educational institutions, right? It was literally against the law for folks who looked like me for much longer than not than the alternative to go to school.
Sure.
Right? And so they merged this notion of meritocracy, ignored those long histories of policy sanction exclusion, and said, those of you who are in the elite spaces aren't there because you haven't worked hard enough, when there was no opportunity to work hard. And I use my own personal story as an example of how egalitarian meritocracy fails, because quite frankly, what is more egalitarian than piecemeal agricultural work, right? What is more meritocratic than being paid contingent upon your productivity?
Sure.
And what is more characteristic of the true story of the United States of America than this person saying to me, I'm not going to pay you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And you need to work hard.
Harder.
You need to learn a lesson here.
Exactly.
But to play devil's advocate here, what do you say to people who say, well, Jay, you are a Black man who has tenure at one of the top schools in the country, maybe the world. You are a living example of this ideology. Do you ever find yourself stuck in that space?
I do. The viral success story, or the sterling example of if you just work hard enough. So a couple of things. I think, what I usually ask is, how much do you actually know about my story and what I've been through? Because very few people do.
Sure.
Right? And then I share some of that narrative, and I lay out in no uncertain terms the different inflection points, particularly where my formal educational attainment is concerned, and how for every step of the way, you know, and it's been significantly more likely that I would not be successful than it has been
sure.
that I would be. And the kind of personal discipline, I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke cigarettes. I've never done any kind of drugs. I live a remarkably and consistently constrained life, all because I recognized that the path that I had to travel was so narrow
yep.
that one slip up in any direction, right, could in the ways that really matter, result in my falling off and not having the resources to fall back upon in terms of my family, right,
uh-huh.
and what they could do for me to get back into the game. So that's one. The second question that I ask often is, at what cost,
yeah.
right? And I submit to you humbly that at every level, and, you know, for the various experiences, my undergraduate education, I was a Peace Corps volunteer, my Peace Corps experience, my master's training, my PhD training, I did a postdoc, one postdoc, then I did I was a research scientist collecting primary data, then I did a second postdoc. I have encountered and have to figure out how to engage and negotiate structural and institutional impediments to success mm-hmm. that have come at a cost. And the cost has been physiological stress, how these differences in those lived experiences of engaging and aspiring, again, to successfully negotiate institutions and systems that often, when they were constructed and designed, didn't consider the perspectives and the experiences of folks like me. And that's best case scenario. Worst case scenario is they did consider folks like me, but they considered only in so much as what
yeah.
can we do to effectively and forever deny access to this resource to those types of folks.
I love what you were just saying, because I think it's so critical to think about those stressors and how there is real scientific bench science evidence about the toll that takes on human bodies. And you've done some really compelling work on this phenomenon, which is called allostatic load. Thanks. I really think that's a term that should be part of everyone's vocabulary.
Yeah.
Can you describe to us what that is and what are some of the manifestations of allostatic load. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So allostatic load, you know, we conceptualize as a measure of physiological stress response, right? And so it's how differences in lived experience get under the skin and become ultimately physically embodied. And there are various algorithms. I've worked with an algorithm that uses as many as 14 biomarkers, biological indicators. And I think we did a paper where we had only 8, right? But we look at, what it proposes is to measure 3 different types of physiological responses. One is those first order hormonal responses to stress, stressful conditions. The second is secondary impacts. And then the third has to do with how those two combine to impact actual systems, right? And so it can affect your cardiovascular health. Certainly, endocrine production. Immune system response. It affects those systems. But I want to step back for a second and talk a little bit about allostasis in general. And that has to do with there's a regular level of functioning that all human beings operate at, right? And physiological stress response in and of itself is not a bad thing. So you have this cascade of hormones. In fact, in terms of human survival, it benefited us. When you go from homeostasis, which is sort of your constant regular state, to allostasis. And allostasis is something happens in your life and it triggers this cascade of hormones, and the hormones pump additional energy into your muscles. Let's say we were still living on the plains of Africa, Fargo ancestors, and they encounter a lion or some other major predator, and that thing happens. You jump higher, you run faster, you fight harder, and so it keeps you alive, right?
Yeah.
But human bodies are not designed to exist in a perpetual state of heightened physiological arousal and stress response, right? And so over time, two things can happen. One, you have that elevated spike and then you come back down. But what previously was your down, your homeostasis begins to be upregulated, right? And so those two things are combined. And so, you know, your baseline becomes elevated over time and you're still encountering those things that require the spike. That just wears your body out over time, right?
Yeah, it does. And a concept that is related to this or possibly derived from this is this concept of weathering.
Mm-hmm.
And you authored an article with the esteemed Arlene Geronimus, a big fan of her work and others, where you describe a weathering hypothesis, saying it suggests that the cumulative biological impact of being chronically exposed to and having to cope with socially structured stressors can increase health vulnerability and accelerate aging in marginalized population. And in this case, I think it was East Detroit that you were in.
Yep.
I'm going to go a little deep in science here. So to explore this, you looked at something called telomere length and in some white blood cells. And basically, telomeres, correct me if I'm wrong, are basically little caps that, that sit on the end of chromosomes, and they try to protect them from damage. And eventually, the chromosomes will be, once they get to a certain level of damage, then they just don't function anymore.
So, yeah.
And so what did you imagine when you were doing the study that telomeres might tell you about the process of weathering related to allostatic load?
Yeah, can I clarify a couple of points as relates to telomeres before I do this? Okay.
Please.
Okay. All right. So they're the protein caps on the end of chromosomes that protect the chromosomes when they reproduce, right? And so every time the chromosome reproduces, this thing is there to protect it, and a little bit of it is lost. And the example that we typically give is think about those little plastic ends on shoelaces, and every time you tie your shoes or if you're walking around, they get degraded, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the rate of the degradation of telomeres can be measured or, you know, as a function of cellular reproduction. Every time the cell reproduces, you know, a particular portion of this is reliably degraded. What we also know is that telomeres are stress responsive. And so oxidative stress accelerates the rate of telomere degradation and accelerates cellular senescence, that is, cellular death. And that process, and so accelerated cellular degradation, is systematically associated with a much broader process of more rapid biological aging, right? But it's not a direct measure of the biological aging. Biological aging is a much broader construct than just that, right? And so I want to make that clear. But and so the Detroit study, we did primary data collection, and this is when I was a research scientist at the University of Michigan, and I had the pleasure of working with Arlene Geronimus, a team of community-based researchers, Amy Schultz and other folks there in the city of Detroit who fostered good relationships with the population there. And we were interested in examining the health impact of being poor versus being not poor for a multi-ethnic, multi-racial sample of Detroit residents. So we were interested in Black Americans in Detroit, white Americans in Detroit, and a population that was of Mexican origin in Detroit. And so, yeah, I spent about 2.5 years driving around Detroit, going to clinics and, you know, enrolling people and helping to teach them how to spit into a tube 3 times a day for 3 days to measure cortisol and to do blood draws.
What did you find? What I got from reading this literature was that the finding that the telomere length gap between poor and non-poor Black participants disappears once stress-related factors are accounted for.
Yep.
And that may suggest that poverty alone is not the primary driver of telomere differences in your group. And it says, instead, it seems as if chronic stress exposure, which disproportionately affects Black individuals across income level, is the main factor.
Right.
And so I'd love for you to speak to a little bit more of that. And I'm very interested in how you hypothesize about how the lack of trust, this is just embedded in structural racism, how that contributes to the stress response, this chronic, cellularly, genetically debilitating stress response that you saw in your study.
Yeah. So we, again, sampled from 3 racial and ethnic populations. And for the whites who were poor, they had significantly shorter telomeres or telomere length than did whites who were non-poor. Hmm. And so going from being poor to being non-poor actually worked for whites the way that the notion of meritocracy suggested it would. And so folks who haven't, you know, who are poor, quote unquote, haven't worked hard, which may not be the case. They may be working very hard, to be clear. But those who are not poor had significantly longer telomeres in Detroit among the whites, right? Blacks who were poor in Detroit actually had telomeres that were longer than poor whites. But going from being poor if you were Black in Detroit to being non-poor did not significantly improve telomeres, right? And so there was not a significant difference between telomere length if you were Black in Detroit versus if you were not Black.
And let's remind again what telomere length represents in this study.
And so it's a measure of accelerated cellular degradation as a function of oxidative stress, stress exposure.
Yep.
And finally, the Mexican origin population in Detroit, those who were poor, had longer telomeres than did poor whites or poor Blacks, right? They had good health. And the Mexican origin population that was not poor had shorter telomeres than the poor Mexican origin population. And so going from being poor to being non-poor in Detroit was systematically associated with worsening health if you were of Mexican origin, right? And so, to answer your prior question, this lack of trust on the part of Black Americans who have a long history of racialized minoritization in the United States of America and being racially minoritized in the United States of America in terms of the experiences that Blacks have when they engage major institutions comprising broader society, may not operate the same for those Black folks as it does for the white folks, right? And so we have, you know, an intergenerational social knowledge of what this thing was constructed to do and what it still continues to do. And this, despite the fact that some of us by conventional metrics are fortunate enough to, quote unquote, be successful. But it should be noted that, you know, the same level of formal education for a Black American in the United States of America does not reliably translate into labor market or employment opportunities, mm-hmm. same as it does for white Americans. If they're fortunate enough to get that job, we have compelling evidence which suggests that the incomes that they can expect to gain from that employment are significantly lower. Additionally, the likelihood of promotion or moving up in an organization is less. And certainly wealth accrual, you know, intergenerational, and then the implications of that for intergenerational transfers are significantly lower for Black Americans. Everything else equal, even at the same level of income, than they are for white Americans, right? And so I submit to you humbly that, you know, we don't all get the same quote-unquote socioeconomic nor health returns upon our egalitarian meritocratic responsible application of these hard-won resources.
Well, you say that. You said the stress potential of these circumstances is heightened when they are interpreted through racial stigma, cultural oppression, or acceptance of the American creed.
That's right.
And reduced by the availability of cultural affirmation, identity, safety, and collective networks where material resources and risks are pooled.
That's right. That's right. And so our way of being, you know, I refer to those as alternative social cultural orientations, right? Other ways of being. In fact, there are at least three, possibly four of these studies I can think of right off the cuff where, you know, social psychologists and some economists actually have done work that explores the value of teaching young Black American and young Latinos, males in particular, that the United States of America is fair and just, egalitarian and meritocratic versus helping them to understand that is not the case and that those principles don't apply to them as the dominant narrative suggested it should. And the kids who are taught the truth, that is, that this has never existed for mm-hmm. people like them, do better on health than the kids who are left to believe that this is actually true.
Right, because they're up against an impossible standard it's not even accessible in the ways that I think we define it sort of at its loosest. And like you said, you have not allowed yourself the flexibility of many elements of humanness, in your life to keep yourself so rigidly adhered to your mission. And I think superordinated folks, as folks with more privilege, have not had to be as subjected. Although I will say, I would argue women fall into the category of having to keep such a rigid kind of moral compass, because any deviation from that can be pointed to as evidence of your incompetence, your bad moral character, sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy of a failure. How do you feel like this ideology of egalitarian meritocracy, both from your experience, from your research, perpetuates greater distrust and really just disdain for economically disadvantaged individuals and then by economically disadvantaged individuals, because it's such a reciprocal process?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. And quite frankly, that's at the gist of what I would like to investigate and come to understand better. And one other thing as I move forward. So, you know, I do believe, based on the research, some of which I just shared with you, that, you know, young folks who are aspiring to success by conventional metrics, if they happen to be minoritized, and you are correct, it's not just racial minoritization, there's gendered minoritization, and even, you know, there's some socioeconomic minoritization also.
I'm from Appalachia. Okay. I'm down with that. It's really real.
But the degree to which, you know, different two-way intersections of race and gender understand how the economic system may or may not work for them is really, really interesting. You know, again, and I know I keep going back to the research.
Please.
But, you know, in the United States of America, there are a number of studies which demonstrate that well-to-do white men who are middle-aged and belong have the highest reported belief in justice and equality through egalitarian meritocracy in the United States of America, right?
Well, it serves them well, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, it's so...
There's no probability of that here baseline.
You know, you've had your priors confirmed, right?
Yes.
Conversely, it is Black American men, particularly those who have attempted to engage these institutions with the expectation of succeeding, who have not succeeded, who have the lowest reported belief in these mechanisms. And, you know, and this brings us to another person. You mentioned Dr. Geronimus, who I trained with and who has profoundly influenced my academic identity. There's also Sherman James, mm-hmm. and his John Henryism hypothesis, work that he did not far from where I grew up, actually, about 45 miles from where I'm from in eastern North Carolina. He did his work in Pitt County, and his early sample was with Black American men. And what he found, he developed the scale called the John Henryism scale of high effort coping. And what he was interested in was measuring the inherent belief and your ability to engage with the expectation of overcoming structural and institutional impediments to success, that you recognize this thing was rough, but you actually believed that you could overcome it. And what he found was that Black American men who scored high on John Henryism and who were indeed successful had lower blood pressure. Black men who scored high on John Henryism and aspired to succeed but failed, right, had elevated blood pressure. Black men who scored low on John Henryism but somehow managed to be relatively socioeconomically successful had lower blood pressure. And Black men who scored low on John Henryism and were not economically successful also had sort of mitigated blood pressure. The difference between the Black men who believed they could succeed and tried, and those who believed they could succeed and failed, was much greater than the Black men who didn't report belief that they could engage this with the expectation to succeed and who were successful, and those who scored low on that scale and were, by conventional metrics, unsuccessful.
First of all, I want you to explain who John Henry is, because I'm singing the song in my head because I grew up with the Steel God of Man. So, but also, what I'm taking away from that, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is something about internalizing this belief that has profound, long-standing effects on your health, and that internalization of those beliefs probably starts at birth.
Early.
Very, very early. But yes, can you tell us who John Henry was?
Yeah, so John Henry is a legend of a Black man who worked on the railroads here in the wonderful United States of America, big, strapping, super powerful Black man who was far and away the most successful at driving the large wooden ties into the metal railway, into rail.
Yep.
Yeah, it was the rails. And so the story goes that an inventor invented a machine to drive those stakes into the railway ties and said that no man could beat his machine. And so they had a competition. Mm-hmm. And John Henry actually won the competition. He worked as hard as any human being could possibly work. In fact, I know that's the case because after he won, he keeled over and died.
Right.
Right? And so he beat the machine. And, you know, what Sherman James suggests is the machine represents the broadest social order of the United States of America.
Yeah.
But at great cost to his own health and well-being, indeed, at the cost of his life, right? Mm-hmm. And he developed this hypothesis when he was working with a Black American man there named John Henry Martin in the 70s and into the 80s, who told him a story of how hard he had worked to be successful by conventional socioeconomic metrics and actually had achieved some modest success for himself and his children, but it had come at tremendous cost to his health and well-being. He had a number of debilitating chronic and degenerative diseases by the time he was in his mid-50s. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And so John Henry Martin lined up with this, the legend of John Henry.
That had to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
That was just meant to be studied.
Yeah.
So I can't end our chat today without acknowledging our shared love of bell hooks.
Yep.
And in her book, All About Love, New Visions, she dedicates a chapter to I Know What You Love, called Love Ethics. And she says, a love ethic presupposes that everyone has the right to be free, live fully and well. Embracing a love ethic means that we utilize all the dimensions of love, care, commitment, trust, responsibility, respect, and knowledge in our everyday lives. Domination cannot exist in any social situation where a love ethic prevails. When love is present, the desire to dominate and exercise power cannot rule the day. All the great social movements for freedom and for justice in our society have promoted a love ethic. Concern for the collective good of our nation, city, or neighbor, rooted in the values of love, makes us all seek to nurture and protect that good.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask you, and this may seem entirely aspirational, a bit naive, but I think it's an important question. I'd love to hear your answer. Given our current state of affairs, which feel the most dire of my life, what trustworthy behaviors can people in power, people with advantage, cultivate and display?
So first of all, thank you for asking that question. I have a great deal of admiration and respect for Sister Bell Hooks, who passed about 2 years ago and had the extreme pleasure of meeting her about 3 decades ago now. But no, this notion of the love ethic, where love is practiced, not emotion, not passion, but a way of recognizing the humanity in all other human beings, right? And so this notion of human dignity, that every one of us is born with an inherent core value that is worthy of recognizing and actually honoring. And then second, integrity of identity. And so everyone gets access to the good things and are protected from the bad things such that they can go about living their best life. And then integrity of identity, which, you know, philosopher Nancy Glaser references, in that no one of us should have to fundamentally or in any way significantly alter core aspects of who we are to be respected as a human being, right? And, you know, if I'm playing you straight, and I intend to, you know, Frederick Douglass in The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro lays out a way forward for this for majoritized folks. And what he says is, you all founding fathers have these documents, the social contract, the Constitution, the preamble, you know, the Declaration of Independence, that comprise our social contract, what the government has agreed to do for the population it proposes to serve. Live into those values. Make that true for all of us, right? Now, keep in mind, again, I mentioned that these were all well-to-do white men who inked those documents, 56 of them. It's documented that at least 44 of those folks either owned slaves or had recently owned slaves at the time of the signing of those documents, and at least that many were complicit in the unjust illegal appropriation of Native Americans' ancestral lands, right? So this notion of egalitarian meritocracy has never existed. But ironically and interestingly enough, there's a framework that in no uncertain terms tells us how to go about honoring that. And it's called this Constitution that these folks keep harking back to, right?
Right.
Right. And I think that Douglass laid it out perfectly. And so, you know, we've now gone from, you know, the forefathers to Douglass to Sister Bell Hooks, Arlene Geronimo, Sherman James, and you've covered the gamut. But yeah.
We have. And how do you respond to people saying, we're doing the right thing and no one is appreciating enough?
You know, so I believe that I'm not sure if you're doing the right thing if you expect some reward, right? I believe that, you know, ethically oriented folks who, quote unquote, have a well-established moral compass, do the right thing because it's the right thing, and they aspire to honor this concept of human dignity that we just discovered, right? And so some of these folks are going to have to learn how to get over themselves. And I'll go one step further and say, and this is something that I'm really interested in now. This is the second thing that, you know, moving forward in my academic career, over the course of the next 15 years or so, if I'm fortunate enough to continue to do this, I want to understand. And that is, what is the role of subordinated majoritized folks who, in perhaps even the most rudimentary sense, understand that you do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, right? And not because you expect to be rewarded or patted on the back or recognized or said, thank you. What is the responsibility or what role do those folks have in helping others who may be liberal and progressive or perhaps not, but who like to believe that they're good, well-intended folks, understand that the history of the United States of America suggests that we've never delivered upon the promise of the Constitution, and that doing that fundamental work should not come with the expectation that you get some special prize. It is the least you can do. Treating human beings humanely should be integral to being a decent human being, hard stuff.
It's your love ethic.
Right, right. That's the love ethic. That's the commitment to honor these core concepts of human dignity, integrity, of identity. Bill Hooks lays it out. Yep.
Well, Dr. Pearson, this has been thrilling as always. I get to spend some time with you this semester, and I've been very lucky to be able to do that, but very tickled to have had this time one-on-one with you. So I thank you so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, before you go, here's a shameless plea. If you like this episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast. That way, you'll never miss a new episode. You can also find more about us at trustfundpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you loved what you heard, I trust you to leave a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Trust Fund is a production of Jill Surgeson and the Duke University School of Nursing.